Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Wednesday. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Coming up in the second hour of the show on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon is back. She's the founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought. She's co-host of the Holistic Living segment. And Lamont Summers will be here as well. He's assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He will have the media report. We have a whole lot to get to on the media report agenda, including, of course, Anthony Scaramucci, the Mooch, as they call him. What a incredible character. We'll get to all of it, though, in the media report coming up in the second hour of the show with Lamont Summers. A little bit later in this first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Tara Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network talking law enforcement and politics, including the discovery of more body camera footage of a Baltimore cop allegedly planting evidence at a crime scene. It seems like every week there is another allegation of misconduct against the Baltimore City Police Department. We will discuss it with the Mod Squad coming up in a little while. But first, the Trump administration is making a push to challenge affirmative action in college admissions. This action by the Trump White House opening a rather volatile debate that has taken place over the course of decades as far as affirmative action in admission to higher education, people fighting to get into the most prestigious schools and the criteria in which it's actually in which people are admitted. Before we begin that conversation, let me remind you to make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition. Or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information inside or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I won't do it. So back to the Trump administration's new push to challenge affirmative action in college admissions. For that, we go to John Bullock, Baltimore City Councilman, Dr. John Bullock, that is, Baltimore City Councilman and former political science professor at Towson University. Brother Bullock, good to hear your voice.
Hey, good to talk to you. I'm still teaching, too.
Okay, I wasn't sure, right? So I erred on the side of conservatism, I guess. But yes, okay, I wasn't sure 100%, but welcome to the show, John. Welcome back to the show. And Matthew Crenson is also on the phone. He is the political science professor emeritus at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Crenson, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course, of course. Let's just cut right to, first of all, before we can even begin the conversation about this new mandate by the Trump administration, is it possible for us to really have this discussion specifically about college admissions and affirmative action without the broader context of the Trump administration 6 months in and what has transpired? Not that we need to discuss everything that has transpired, but ultimately any mandate, any policy that the Trump administration puts forward has to be viewed through a much different lens than any other presidency in our history. I mean, is that an overstatement?
Well, no, I think this is not yet a mandate, but it is characteristic of the Trump administration. It's a gesture. It's designed to strike a chord with a certain part of his constituency. It's what's called a personnel posting. The Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice has sent a letter, an internal letter, inviting its attorneys to submit resumes to become active on this issue, that is to fight affirmative action. However, it doesn't apply to the Office of Educational Opportunities, which is where the career Justice Department employees work. This is only for political appointees.
Right.
I don't even know how many political appointees have been nominated yet. No. The Trump administration has been very slow to do so.
Yeah, that's true.
So this is just an invitation to file suits. And it's not clear at this point what basis the suits would rest on.
Dr. Bullock, is this a political gesture? It may be, but also isn't this simply a misdirection or a redirection away from the catastrophic failures or the catastrophic scandals that have been connected to this administration in the last weeks, months, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with my colleague. I mean, the fact is that this is characteristic of this type of presidency. It's quite unorthodox. You would normally not see a White House talking about directing the Justice Department in such a way, most specifically the Civil Rights Division. But it's also emblematic of his message thus far, which has really been stoking these resentments, especially right. racialized resentments. This white backlash, this perceived black progress, and the whole theory of affirmative action is seen as this, quote, reverse racism, as it's been touted since the 70s when you have the University of California Bakke case and other those all along the way. So the fact that this is this, quote, discrimination aimed at white students, it really does speak to the base that he's playing to and the political chaos that we're seeing right now.
And it's also an exaggeration.
Certainly.
Since the Bakke decision that you mentioned, I mean, most college and universities have found ways within the law to increase the diversity, especially the racial diversity of their student populations. The Bakke case ruled out racial quotas.
Right.
But the courts have said, most recently in 2016, that it's okay for universities to try to increase the racial diversity of their student bodies.
Right.
And that means that race can be taken into account as one factor among many in making admissions decisions, provided that there aren't other ways of achieving the same end.
Well, and so Professor Crenson, you just peeped my whole card because I was going to refer to the fact that the University of Texas case is now, since it's gone to the Supreme Court, this is settled law. And as you just mentioned, as you just alluded to, race can be one of the determining factors in admission to colleges to promote diversity on the nation's college campuses. So what is the Trump administration even... What is their angle here, for lack of a better term?
They're probably going to try to turn that around based on the changed composition of the Supreme Court. That's one possibility. But the fact is that most colleges and universities have found ways of increasing the racial diversity of their student bodies without explicitly using race as a criterion for admission. For example, my own university, Johns Hopkins, I was a faculty director of the Baltimore Scholars Program for 8 years. That's our way of reaching out to Baltimore and the public schools of Baltimore, where a majority of the student population is African-American. And we have increased the number and percentage of African-American students attending Hopkins as undergraduates through the use of that scholarship program. Other universities have used other methods of doing the same thing. For example, at Harvard, if you come from a family where the annual gross income is $60,000 or less, you attend for free. That opens Harvard to a lot of students, including minority students, who wouldn't otherwise be able to attend. The University of California, Berkeley, reaches out to Oakland, where there's a large African-American population. So there are ways of doing this that don't necessarily involve racial quotas or racial preferences.
But ultimately, if the Trump administration, John Bullock, was able to flip the court, if you will, or reverse this decision because of the composition, the new composition of the court, ultimately, any type of decision that would reverse this decision that came in 2016, wouldn't it dissuade or would it deter some colleges and universities from implementing some of the programs that Professor Crenson just mentioned?
You know, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, look at it this way. I mean, the composition of the court has changed, you think about from 78 on to 2016, how it's changed, and the court has been pretty consistent with looking at race as one of the factors. And even to the point before around the different ways you can look at diversity, you know, there are all types of diversity that the universities are looking for, right? So we can look at region of where the student's coming from. Are they an athlete? Are they involved in the arts? Is there an income change? Because as educators, we recognize having a diverse student body, whether we're talking about racially, geographically, or what have you, is something that's a benefit. And that's what admission committees look at. I think one of the real challenges here is that you have students who apply to schools, and oftentimes there are students who are marginal who don't get accepted. There are students who are high-performing who get denied from certain institutions for a variety of reasons. So I still believe that institutions will find ways to be creative as it relates to having a student body that's balanced on all the factors we just mentioned.
Yeah, and excuse me. And the courts have said repeatedly that achieving a diverse student body, that's a legitimate objective of admissions policy.
Understood. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. I am talking to Matthew Crenson. He is a political science professor emeritus at Johns Hopkins University. And Dr. John Bullock, Baltimore City Councilman Dr. John Bullock, a political science professor at Towson University. We're talking about the Trump administration's new push to challenge affirmative action in college admissions. Let me read a statement from Bowie State University that we got. We reached out to them to be a part of this discussion. Bowie State, of course, one of the historically black colleges and universities. We are obviously on the campus of the premier HBCU, I think, in the state. But Bowie State sent this message, quote, admission to the institutions of the university system of Maryland shall be determined without lawful discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, gender, age, sexual orientation, or disabling condition. The undergraduate student population at USM institutions should draw from all areas of the state and reflect the diversity of the state's population, et cetera, et cetera. Kind of boilerplate standard reply to these types of challenges. But ultimately, what is not standard is the Trump administration, quite frankly. And going back to my first question that I kind of opened with, you are both veteran political observers. How do we begin to wrap our minds around what has transpired over just the last few weeks of the Trump administration? It's hard to really take any sort of policy, agenda or item seriously from this White House, at least in my mind, when the backdrop is so catastrophically, what do you make of, as veteran political observers, what do you make of what has transpired?
Well, that's what I said, it's a gesture. It's a gesture because the administration is so weak on follow-through. It's almost impossible for them to bring anything to a conclusion. It's a gesture to its base, but it may also be a gesture to college and university. It's a kind of intimidation, a kind of threat that's likely to make university administrators at least a little bit nervous. They're going to go to their legal counsel's office now much more to check their admissions policies.
I get that, Professor. I get that, Professor Crenson. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get your point from even earlier when you stated that. But I mean, my point here that I'm asking you both is, how does anyone, whether it be at a government level, whether it's the national government, whether it's the Congress or state level or college administrators, how can anyone, any entity involved in governance, if you will, in the United States, really take this White House seriously, given what has transpired with the most recent Scaramucci thing, the multiple defeats of Trump Care, just so many losses, and this president promised wins.
Well, certainly you can't take it seriously. I mean, we're talking about an administration that's very chaotic, it's very disorganized, and you know it really is more so of a gesture. I look at it also through this lens. You know, even there's been over the past several years and even decade, you might say, response to the so-called liberal nature of universities and liberal professors, and I think that's also an outreach to that base that feels that college campuses have been a place where conservative views have then been downgraded, and so this is also reaching out to them. The other piece that I think this is important to tie to, so I say this as someone who is a graduate of a historical black college, Hampshire University, and two majority institutions, University of North Carolina, University of Maryland, now at Towson. You look at flagship state institutions and the resources that they've gotten and how they have been largely predominantly white for so long, and now as demographics are changing at the state level and national level, you're seeing that backlash. I would also tie this to historical black colleges, since you mentioned Bowie State. You think about what happens in terms of the Trump administration's outreach or lack thereof to historically black colleges, and that no resources have really come, and there's no agenda as it relates to historically black colleges. So he is not only not addressing these issues, but then also giving lip service to his base.
I think Professor Book is absolutely right. And in fact, there's a recent survey by the Pew Center that shows how Republicans and Democrats view universities and colleges. Republicans are much more negatively oriented toward colleges and universities than Democrats are. And same between liberals and conservatives.
And then even look at the turnout in the last election and where Trump did well versus non-college educated, and also looking at where they all were along the, the ideological spectrum, certainly.
Is there an opportunity, and I'm using the word in quotes, an opportunity for the Trump administration to, through this type of policy prescription that, or this gesture that they're putting forward, to begin to meddle, if you will, for lack of a better term, in the process of schools of historically black colleges and universities and funding? Because I've heard that type of reporting that that the Trump administration earlier in their administration was looking at funding of black schools as far as them getting special, quote unquote, funding because they have because of the status of being an HBCU.
I'd be surprised to see any real resources coming in that regard. I mean, even the president.
Well, I'm saying taken away, actually, from HBCUs.
I think you're correct in that way. You know, you look at the outreach that President Obama was doing in terms of historically black colleges and universities. That doesn't exist at this point. I think there's also thinking about what happened in California in the 90s and looking at different propositions and how that also affected the enrollment of some state institutions with black students. And many of them started coming eastward towards some of these HBCUs. But I think your point is well taken that the historical black colleges and universities are really at a perilous point given the lack of relationship between the federal government, specifically the president's office.
Yeah, and I think higher education in general is going to take a hit, already has, under the Trump administration, from Pell Grants, student loans, research funds, it's all going to diminish, and I think higher education in general is going to be hurting. There is one way that historically black institutions might counter this or respond to it, put its thumb right in the president's eye, say, okay, we want affirmative action for white students to come to historically black institutions.
Well, that's a whole nother conversation, especially here in the state of Maryland.
I know.
but for another show. But in these last few minutes while I have you both, I'm going to ask it in a different way. As political observers, what do you make? How do you assess the first 6 months of this presidency?
I mean, we'll go first, Professor Bowles.
Well, I've seen everything. I think dumpster fire. I've seen that a few times, and I think that says a lot. I mean, just the turnover has been ridiculous from the communications department. You look at the chief of staff. You think about all the scandals. You know, it's very interesting the way that he talked about we'll be winning, and people will be so tired of winning, and then talked about if Clinton were elected, there'd be scandals and everything. I mean, everything from Russia. I mean, it is really just chaotic. And I explain to my students that I've been around for some time, and I've never seen anything like this. This is not typical. I mean, I don't care if you're talking about a Republican administration or Democratic. We've never seen anything like this. Not only is he a political novice, but even just the level of ineptitude that we're seeing from the Oval Office is beyond the pale.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this administration deserves the record for having the most foul-mouthed communications director in history. A colleague and I, a few years ago, wrote a book about the American presidency going all the way back to the beginning. It's not just that I haven't seen in my lifetime any president like this. There has never been a president like this in American history. This guy makes James Buchanan look good. and that takes some doing. This is a chaotic administration. I can't even regard it seriously. It may change now that it has a new chief of staff. But I have my doubts. I think that the chief of staff and the president are going to come to blows pretty soon, and I think we're going to be back to business as usual, which is not to do any business at all.
I get that the possibility of the 45th president finishing out his term is very real, but But given the size, the magnitude of the scandals we've seen so far, as you both described, the ineptitude, the incompetency, how can this White House not collapse in on itself, implode in on itself?
Even if it doesn't implode, there's a time bomb ticking out there, and that's the Mueller investigation.
Ah, indeed.
Yes,
I'm have to believe that such things that we haven't seen, like the president's tax returns,
Mueller allegedly has access to them.
Right, and I think there, even before the administration collapses, there may be an explosion.
Mm. And I would add to that, thinking about his connection or this lack of relationship with Congress. And so now you're not only belittling, you know, your secretaries, but you're also belittling Congress, and you have to work with them. So you have a majority, and you're not able to get anything done at this point. And now you're also looking at the potential of a mutiny, where now, you know, you're the figurehead of a party, and that you clearly do not speak for the majority, and they want to distance themselves from you, especially as now we're getting on to midterm elections. It's going to be something to see.
I mean, you saw the reaction of the Republicans when Trump attacked Sessions. It was pretty definitive. I think that's a clear signal to him that he's treading on very, very treacherous water.
And now that he's begun to attack Congress directly, some of the Republicans in Congress are beginning to repudiate him. We may wind up with a president without a party.
Mm. Absolutely.
Well,
because they realize they need to save their own skin. I mean, at this point, I mean, he's tanking not only himself and his presidency, but their party, their chances for reelection, and what happens in the future.
Absolutely true. 2018 is only a small several months away, and many Republicans and Democrats have an eye on what is going to transpire during the midterms.
Yeah. The Democratic challengers in the House have raised many, many millions of dollars more than the Republicans already.
And look at those town hall meetings where they're getting shouted down by their own constituents and they have nothing to show for it.
Absolutely. Dr. John Bullock is Baltimore City Councilman from the 9th District, also a professor at Towson University. Brother Bullock, it's always good to hear your voice. Thank you,
always,
man.
Always great to be on. Thanks for your work, sir.
And Professor Matthew Crenson is professor of political science emeritus at Johns Hopkins University. He's author of the book Downsizing Democracy, Building the Invisible Orphanage, and Presidential Power Unchecked and Unbalanced. Professor Crenson, it was a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Of course. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Stephen Janis and Taya Graham of the Real News Network, talking politics and law enforcement. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Sean Yoes, your host, making the transition from national politics to the work of the Mod Squad. That is Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Friends, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Sean, we're glad to be here.
Unfortunately, there's the recurring narrative.
Yes. The endless recurrence of the same is what's happening.
Yeah, infinite recurrence of the same. That's Nietzsche. Yeah. But that doesn't mean, I don't know if he was applying that to Baltimore City Police Department.
Well, perhaps. That's exactly what I was applying it to.
It's getting to the point where we're seeing these travesties of justice over and over again on video in front of our eyes, and it's just so disheartening. I mean, I don't even know what to say about it anymore.
Well, I do.
The la- I mean, and we'll get to the specifics of that case. And for those who don't know, there was another video, reports of another
body
video,
cam, yeah.
body cam mm-hmm. video, showing a police officer allegedly planting evidence, drug evidence, or evidence at a
drug
crime
evidence.
Scene. Drug
yeah,
evidence.
Yeah, drug evidence.
Mm-hmm. At a crime scene.
In a car. In an automobile.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, again, we'll get to the specifics of that yeah. in a minute. But the reality is that we haven't even finished the aftermath of the first
no.
exactly.
video.
As a matter exactly. of fact, Baltimore City Police Department, or the city, let's say, in general, outperformed itself. We were on the front page of the New York Times, or the front page of the New York Times website, yet again, about the first case. Before anybody could even digest the second case, the first case has managed to make the front page of the New York Times website, which, you know, for, I can think of multiple instances where, you know, beyond just Freddie Gray, where that has happened, this department has managed to make national news quite efficiently.
It's not doing a great deal for our reputation as a city or no. for the Baltimore City Police Department's reputation.
And particularly because both these cases came after the Department of Justice
exactly.
report. The two cases that we're talking about, one happened in January 2016, this one happened in November 2016. So they're both after.
But the first one was January.
First one, the first one, 2017. Sorry, yeah. First one was January 2017, November 2016. So they both happened after the Justice Department came and said, "This is what you guys are doing is wrong. It's right. illegal. Stop.
Unconstitutional.
Unconstitutional.
Yes. Unconstitutional.
Et cetera,
illegal
et cetera.
Tactics. Yes.
And these cases, and you know, it's a body cam, which is supposed to be exonerating for officers.
Right, that was supposed to be, you know, somewhat of a panacea for police mm-hmm. to protect police officers,
right.
because
from
if you're
false
not
accusations.
Right, exactly true. And what has happened, at least in Baltimore, yeah. is that it has been the great revealer.
Right, it's mm-hmm. proven that what the community has been saying has been true and accurate all along. That there have been police officers who've been taking advantage of their power and planting drugs and guns on people, as evidenced by yeah. the Gun Trace Task Force and the recent
one.
Footage that we've just witnessed.
I wonder what their body cams be like. Wow, it'd be well, like watching Training Day, but the uncut version.
Yeah.
Let's ask this question because mm-hmm. Stephen, you write about it this week in the mm-hmm. Afro. What where is the accountability mm-hmm. for this department? Not just within the department, but within City Hall.
Yeah, I mean the thing is that these scandals come and go, and City Hall seems very reluctant to push back. And I talked to some veterans of City Hall, including Carl Stokes, who said, you know, you have to speak out. He said, if you don't, these problems get buried and they come back. And one of the things I wrote about was the case of Officer Cossum and Colin Trance, you know,
Trust.
Who was, Trust, mm-hmm. excuse me, Trance.
He was in a trance.
He got banked.
Yes.
Sorry, I just had to say that because Sean
like
taught
that.
Me a word. Banked. And he got banked. It's not even funny. I apologize for being but it was just something. So, you know, it was a case in 2014 when a police officer, you know, two police officers, one held a guy and one
the
beat him
up. The white officer held his arms behind his back as the black officer
beat
delivered several
then wrote that the, you know, the suspect had attacked him and it was all a lie, ended up being a national story. And at the time, the mayor refused to call for this officer's firing and said, you know, you guys think it's all peaches and cream, as Tan and I've
right.
talked about. So, you know, these things keep happening.
But
and
I have to go back to that Cossum situation. Okay. Let's break it down a little bit because that video is etched in my mind.
Oh, yes.
Because
it's like the Rodney King
the
video.
The reason mm-hmm. because I've seen these guys on the streets. I mean, the cops. I've seen these same guys who didn't have badges beating guys up,
mm-hmm.
stealing
wow.
their money. Mm. Beating them up over whatever. I mean, I've seen this 100 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I saw it, I was like, whoa. I mean,
it's familiar.
Take off the badge. Take off the gun. Because
right.
you're not
you're
a
saying.
Cop now.
No.
You're just a dude.
Yeah.
Just
a
thug.
I mean, literally a dude. You got your boys holding somebody while the guy's girl is trying to pull him away from the situation.
Yeah, I mean,
desperately trying to protect
the guy,
her.
The victim wasn't an aggressor at all.
No, he's they're coming out of a liquor store on the corner of Greenmount and North.
Mm-hmm.
He's stumbling out.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and then you know the cop is antagonized. You can
absolutely.
See it.
He's
egging him on.
Come.
You can read the body language.
And then,
you can tell.
And then when he gets the opportunity and his boys are there. Then he decides he's going to square off on him.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, this is...
But it wasn't a fair
right.
fight because he had
and
an officer holding his arms behind his back.
Two cops were holding his one, and then, holding one and the other was holding the other.
His his girlfriend or a female companion gets in front of the cop.
Yeah, she tried to protect her boyfriend.
And the cop just keeps on going.
Yeah.
She was desperately, you could tell that she was on the verge of crying, and she was desperately trying to protect her boyfriend.
Well, what's telling about that case is that the mayor, you know, pulled punches and refused to really call out the officer. You
yeah,
know,
she said policing's an ugly business.
Policing's an ugly business. And so what happens a year later? Well, it gets real ugly.
Yes.
It gets real ugly for this city. And I'm sure the mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, would like to take that back on some level, or maybe wish she'd done something. I don't know.
Maybe. But the bottom line, the reason I wanted to bring that up is that was an egregious example.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of, I mean, it made national news.
No, it was. I asked the mayor, I said, should he be fired? And she said, you know, it's not up for me to decide, basically. She wouldn't say it. I mean, I remember it because it's indelibly etched in my psyche about that, because I just couldn't believe. I said, what do these guys have to do to get a reprimand from City Hall?
Right.
And, you know, if you look at this current video, do you want us to go into the specifics of the current video?
Yeah, what kind of evidence do you have to present before someone is fired?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, obviously, you have to go through a process. It's a dual process. They have to have an internal investigation. If there's a criminal, that has to be done first. Then they have a trial board. If they disagree with the punishment, the commissioner can ultimately fire them. But there is a long procedure. Nevertheless, I mean, the commissioner ultimately makes the decision.
Kasem eventually did get fired.
Yeah. Well, he pled guilty
and
to assault. And spent 6 months in prison, so no, he's not a cop anymore. Yeah. And then only one of the Trace Task Force officers have resigned thus far, of the Notorious Seven. Should we call them the Notorious Seven?
Or the Baltimore Seven. The Baltimore Seven.
I've seen different reports suggesting that the seven were the entirety of the Gun Trace Task Force. Is that true?
I don't think so. I think there were three shifts on that one.
Okay.
I think there was a whole unit. I think there were 21 officers.
Okay.
I believe. But someone can correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not sure.
The person I spoke to said there were other units. Now, I don't know if they were exactly called the Gun Trace Task Force, but there were tasks with similar things, and when you watch this video that we're talking about, you will see it's a very similarly situated group of white guys in jeans, vests, which the commissioner said he was going to get rid of, standing around, pulling someone over because they smelled marijuana, you know. And let's think of Tyrone West. They pulled him over because they thought he
had drugs. How do you smell marijuana in a moving car?
I don't know, man. These guys must have olfactory senses like Superman.
I was going to say, that's pretty amazing thing to be able to do.
And they must be like
to be able to smell marijuana in a moving car that's ahead of you on the road.
Like canines. Yeah. It's an amazing thing. And that was the whole probable cause.
And yet again, in this video, you'll see that there's a period of time where they turn the body camera off. And I'm hoping that perhaps one of Sean's listeners is a police officer and will be able to let us know when it is appropriate and allowed for an officer to turn his camera off in the middle of investigation or traffic
stop. Should we break it down a
little
bit?
If it is allowable.
So to break it down, what happened was, as we know, there was a video out that showed police officers turning on his camera and then discovering evidence. This is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It shows a scene. It starts out with a body cam being turned on, and there's a car that's pulled over, and the officer is confronting the driver, saying, "Get out of the car, get out of the car." Get out
right,
of the car.
A female who keeps on insisting. She says, first tell me, why have you pulled me over?
Why do you have me here?
And why do I have to get out of my car?
I'm driving to the store. Why are you harassing me? The officer refuses to answer her, refuses to give her an answer for the reason. Meanwhile, while they are talking, that her male companion is pulled out of the car and handcuffed.
Dragged out of the car and handcuffed.
And he's very
upset. Made to stand on the sidewalk without his shoes on.
So after a lot of coaxing and some words exchanged, they pull her out of the car and they handcuff her. Still haven't really told her what this is about. I think someone mentioned smelling marijuana.
Right.
So they pull her out of the car, and in doing so, they begin to search. And when I say they search every nook and cranny of that car.
Taking out pockets of clothing.
Yeah.
And every
at this point, I count four plainclothes officers.
And then they call for a supervisor,
So there's six police officers, a car sitting at the end of this lane. I'm not exactly sure where the location is, all standing around. This search goes on for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
For 20 minutes, they are rifling through every part of the car. Meanwhile, you know, she's still asking, why am I being pulled over? Why am I being detained? My handcuffs hurt.
And she also, at least she did insist on a female police officer for the search. She said, I want a female police officer. Don't put your hands on
that would be for a cavity search. Right. I don't know if they did that. then, you know, the interesting part of the video, they have her male companion, shoe had fell off, and he's trying to put his shoe on while in handcuffs,
yeah.
and no one helps him.
They actually had taken both his shoes off, and he was trying to slip his feet back
So no one obviously helped him put his shoes back on, so he's sort of jumping around. So 20 minutes goes by, nothing happens. The camera goes off. The timestamp is around 11:53.
So for the 20 minutes that they're searching, the camera's on.
And they don't find anything.
Then he turned the camera off.
30 minutes later, according to the timestamp, the camera comes on. You see the three or four officers standing there. One of them dives his head back down into the front passenger seat. Suddenly comes up and goes, "Oh, look what I found." He comes out with a black bag that's tied together. Very common, you know, sort of stereotypical, cliche drug package.
Package of marijuana and
purportedly
heroin.
Contains heroin and marijuana.
Right.
In a quantity sufficient to arrest this woman. And I might add, as Taya pointed out, they were already talking about impounding
her car. They were already going
to
impound her car. So even if they hadn't found, this woman was already going to be visiting central booking. She was going to have to pay hundreds of dollars to get her car out of the impound.
And they're going
to
impound her car.
Because they were trying to take her car keys from her. And she said, "Why are you taking my car keys?" And they're like, "Well, we'll just have your car towed without the keys. That's fine."
Yeah.
So, I mean, what's just amazing to me is this whole process. There was no reason for all this taxpaper money and time. If they actually did have a small amount of marijuana on them, that's decriminalized.
Yeah.
That's actually an
offense. 10 grams or less.
10 grams or less. They actually didn't need to be arrested for that.
So they're both in handcuffs. And then so then the police are like, "Look what we got." And then
30 seconds. They turn the camera back on 30 seconds
later. Well, they turn the camera 30 minutes later.
30 minutes later.
But after they turned it on, it was 30 seconds.
Under a minute. So this officer had the foresight to turn his camera on and then just immediately afterwards find the drugs they've been looking for over a half an hour.
And I urge everyone to watch because the Baltimore Sun has posted it, and we'll be posting a story about it quite soon. They're standing there kind of like, "You guys ready? Action, camera."
Action, camera,
because they're all standing
sound,
there.
Go.
And then one guy goes, "Let me look in here again," or doesn't say anything. He does that. Then he goes, "Oh." Like I said,
it is pretty amazing that he knew to turn his camera back on just seconds before he found the stash they've been looking for all along. So it's an amazing coincidence.
Yeah. So
let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to take a wild guess here. They're black. The people were there.
Yes, you are absolutely correct.
They were black?
Oh. Yes, they were black.
Yes.
Yes.
African-American. And every single police officer was white.
Right. It wasn't until they called a supervisor that an African-American officer showed up.
But he was in uniform.
And in uniform.
To go without uniform in the Baltimore City Police Department, it helps to be white. So, there were like four white guys standing around in vests and jeans.
But they did count their money in front of the camera because one of the passengers had $99 on them, and they counted out the money in front of the camera and then put it aside.
But they probably confiscated it. I mean, we don't know. We'll ask. We're going to interview. Hopefully,
that's part of the problem with civil forfeiture. Those people are going to have to go to court to try to get their money back. Their $99 back.
I'm sure I
got $99, but.
Yeah, so I'm sure we hopefully will be speaking to the attorney of the person who was arrested, which the charges were dropped, as in the other cases. And as is the Marilyn Mosby press conference, you know, a week ago, 34 cases of the other body cam footage with officers were dropped. These were not the same officers, though.
No,
There's more where they came from.
Just after we found cops planting drugs in the alley now.
We said there would be more video.
Oh yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think this is the beginning of a drop that's about to turn.
There's going to be a torrent.
Because
his
attorneys start to figure
video.
Out in these drug cases. Let me just subpoena the body cam footage, and the police warrant cannot not give it over. Like they could deny the.
They
press.
Could lose it. I know in some cities body camera footage has gone missing.
I think it automatically goes to the state's attorney's office or something. And the state's attorney's office is now reviewing tons of body camera footage. Oh, we're going to see more of this.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt.
If you just stellar investigative techniques,
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host. I'm in the studio with the Mod Squad. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. We're talking about yet another incident of alleged police misconduct, more video footage, more body cam footage of an officer allegedly planting evidence at a crime scene. Let's take a couple of phone calls. Let's go to Ernest first in West Baltimore. Ernest, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Yeah. Unfortunately, this planting of evidence has been going on for a very long time. The perfect example of planting of evidence and lying and perjury and misconduct by police is in the O.J. Simpson trial. And the Christopher Commission brought that out. Hmm. However, one thing that we're not talking about today is that senseless murder over at Giant by the Baltimore County Police Department.
Oh, yeah.
And that was absolutely sentenced.
He had just shoplifted a couple items, right?
Yes.
Yeah. A box of soap powder.
A box of soap powder?
Yeah, something like that. Something insignificant. And they shoot the man. He shoots the man to death. Mm-hmm. And no police department, do they teach you to reach in the car while the car is moving to try to take the key out of the ignition. First of all, the ignition could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be necessarily on the steering wheel.
No, it doesn't.
That's true.
It could be on the console. But what happens is this. Officers periodically put themselves in danger. They put themselves in danger. And that allows them to shoot. Now, if you go to a search engine, the Google search engine, and Google this, officers being officers killing people that's driving cars, you will see how many people have been killed. In Florida, they said in Florida they was killing, every 2.5 days they was killing a black person that was driving a car. Mm. I mean,
that's like the case in Cincinnati.
And guess what? Let's see if they're going to justify this shooting.
Okay.
You know, they tried to make it, oh, he was dragged, and we don't know how far he was dragged. And see.
All right, Ernest, thank you. Got to keep moving, though. Let's go to Seth in Charles Village, who has a question. Seth, you're on with the Mod Squad. Seth?
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Hello?
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Hold on.
Is this our Seth?
Hopefully it can be better now.
I'm not sure.
I had a question for you guys.
It is our Seth. That's our Seth. How you doing?
Well, fine. hopefully you can hear me better now.
A little bit.
I had a question for you guys. First I saw a Real News Network van going down Lombard Street. I was like, hey, the mod.
Good.
I had a question for you guys. Is the live feed for the cameras, the body cameras on the police van, is it a live feed or after the shift, do they turn the footage in and somebody reviews it?
No, they have to hand the footage over.
It's not a live feed.
What happens is, I think every time end of shift, the officers download the video camera footage into a server at the police department, and it's stored. But no, it's not live. That would be really interesting.
That would be interesting. Yeah. Seth, thank you for that question. I mean, maybe they need a live feed.
I was just thinking that. That's not a bad idea, actually. And you know, actually, that is a way that citizens could provide some oversight. We could have our citizens actually take a look at it and keep an eye on things.
But so okay, we have callers, or we have one caller, or some people that believe that just that law enforcement police are infallible, which is a really dangerous kind of position, I think, especially in the current atmosphere that we find ourselves in. But the vast majority of people know that that's not true. But also the vast majority of people know that the vast majority of police officers conduct themselves professionally with dignity. But there's too many incidents. I mean, there's too much to deny. There's too much to ignore. There's too much to turn your head and stick your head in the sand and act like there's nothing wrong.
Right.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's beyond ridiculous because people's I mean, we've talked for years. We reported for years on the aftermath of zero tolerance. They were trying to implement this bogus gun law that would have been a mini little zero tolerance burst in effect. It didn't. Thank God the city council didn't allow that to happen. But thousands of people have been harmed irreparably because
of this
police department.
And the question is, if we really have this crisis of violence, is this really how we want to spend our money to solve it? By having five guys pull over a woman driving in a car and take 2 hours, 3 hours to find a bag of drugs? I mean, is that really?
Or plant the bag of drugs.
But
is that really, if that's, then we live in a city that's so clueless politically that it's hard to even understand. When you watch that, and, you know, we were just down at the Baltimore the City Lab, which is sponsored by Atlantic Magazine, Michael Bloomberg, everybody's mm-hmm. talking about using Instagram and blah, blah, blah. And then you watch this video and you're like, what? Why are you even having these conversations about Instagram?
I know.
When you have people on the street that you're paying, all those guys, I bet, make 80, 90, 100 grand.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
And who knows what they make in overtime?
That's
what they
exactly
make in
overtime. What I was thinking.
Really?
Overtime.
And you're having this conversation about posting vacant homes on Instagram, and this is your solution to crime?
Right. The City Lab program, they were discussing ways to, you know, help cities that are suffering from blight and vacant housing. And the video that they played showed an innovation in technology using Instagram and gathering data that way to help a city. And you're right. It seems a bit absurd that we're talking about these high-tech solutions.
Let's go back a little bit in history. Remember, the FOP was vehemently opposed to the body cameras, and now we know why, right? Mm. Because let's be thankful that at least, remember, the city, Mayor Stefanelli's like initially vetoed the body camera program.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? They should have made this their number one priority, because thank God we're seeing this, so we can actually see how, I mean, we all knew, and Sean, you're right, we reported about these specialized units and how terrible they were, but now, you know, I'm going to post this video. I want everyone to watch it, because I want everyone to see where your tax dollars are going. If you're not offended at the misprosecution of the law, then at least be offended by the fact that you probably just spent $20,000 for this arrest.
Yeah, right? An absolute waste of money. And that City Lab, solution summit that they had gathered that we're looking at, we were listening to Mayor Pugh being interviewed by The Atlantic. We listened to Mayor Bloomberg talk.
Promise.
And everything sounded great. And they were talking about gathering data and finding tech solutions. We don't need more data. We know what's wrong with our city. Mm. Do we really have any questions about what's wrong with our city? We need solutions that are actually going to help. We need body camera footage, body cameras that stay on all the time with the officers. Maybe the residents need body cameras too.
Yeah. Let me go to Professor Doug Colbert of the University of Maryland. Professor Colbert, welcome back to the Mod Squad.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure. Hello, everyone.
Hello, hey, Professor Colbert. Great to hear from you.
So I'm going to repeat a theme that I mentioned at least once before here, that Baltimore is one of the few places in the country where the police actually bring the criminal charges against people. There's
right
no
That's
prosecutorial
right.
review until after a person's already in the system. Almost every other place I know in the country, the prosecutor reviews the police actions first. And, you know, the conscientious prosecutor is going to identify the police who are making consistently making bad arrests or doing the kinds of things, conduct, that later results in a dismissal. But if the prosecutor's office was reviewing certain police officers whom, let's just say the public defender knows a certain number of police who are consistently engaged in bad arrests, you're able to identify the officers, you're able to keep people's from coming into a criminal justice system where it'll take a month or two sometimes, most of the time, before the cases are dismissed. And we're fortunate that we have a state's attorney that's actually dismissing cases, because in other parts of the country, that doesn't happen as soon as a public defender brings it to someone's attention. So I think we really ought to call, we need checks and balances in our system.
Yeah.
Right now, the police have more power in our city than they do in almost every other city, and it's a historic thing. It's a thing where, and Ernest knows this, and he and others bring up the point that this is nothing new. But what would be new is not, okay, the police make an arrest, that's within their power. But before the arrest becomes criminal charges, a prosecutor must review the actions of the officer.
Right.
Again, if you have a conscientious prosecutor reviewing this scenario, it all points to the idea that this didn't happen the way the officer said it happened,
yes.
And the case wouldn't get prosecuted, and the police department would then be able to identify these officers who were engaged in this behavior and take action.
Mm. Doug, let me ask you this, and we don't have a lot of time, but how can this department continue to operate given the specter of what has already been discovered, and what may be lying in the lying on the horizon as far as more allegations of misconduct as the state's attorney's office continues to pour through tons of videotape, body cam videotape. Once a week, it seems like there are new allegations of misconduct. How can the department continue to function in any shade or semblance of normalcy under these circumstances?
Well, actually, John, I look at the glass as half full. I think it's a terrific sign that we're actually able to identify the wrongful police conduct. Mm-hmm. I mean, the public defender's office certainly deserves a good deal of credit, but there was a significant delay there, I understand it, before the tapes initially got reviewed. So I think what we want to do here, if the police are going to function and regain trust of community, then we have to take advantage of the fact that we do have a federal court that's overseeing police behavior now. We are in the process of choosing a monitor who really has to be somebody who has the trust of the community. And we must pursue all of these different avenues. This is not just a situation where we're looking at one type of police behavior. And again, when we say police behavior, we're not talking about all the police, but it's the ones who feel they can get away with this. Mm. So we really have to get rid of this code of silence. Mm. We really have to make sure that a police commissioner who certainly has given every indication that he has no tolerance for this stuff, but at the same time, we have to hear from the people in law enforcement and not just the retired officers, but we have to be able to have some type of a NAP hearing. You know, in New York City, long ago, we had NAP hearings that talked about all of these bad practices. And we were able to get public testimony. We were able to really bring in folks. And actually, the prosecutor worked with the public defender to identify the officers who engage in conduct. So there's a lot that can be done here, Sean. The opportunity is now, though.
Yeah. Doug Colbert is professor of law at the University of Maryland. Doug, we thank you for your insight as usual.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, it's the only way I can say hello to the Mott question.
Thank you, Doug. Talk to you
take
soon.
Take good care.
You too,
bye-bye.
Man. Let's take one more quick call. Let's go to Jay quickly. Jay, you're on with the Mott Squad.
How are you guys doing?
Doing okay.
Good,
doing.
Thank you.
Good. Hey, look, I was listening to you guys. To be honest with you, they need to start from scratch with the Baltimore City Police Department. Mm-hmm. Start from the top all the way down to the bottom, get rid of everybody. I know it sounds ridiculous, but honestly, there's no way else to do it because of all the foolishness that's been going on with the police department down there. If Camden, New Jersey can do it, we can do the same thing. Well, that's what I feel.
Well, Jay, thank you for your call. And quite frankly, there are
people
more
who agree with him.
Who agree with you that don't think it's
officers
ridiculous.
You know, used to work there.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that I know a really excellent police officer who agrees with you 100%, worked in the Baltimore City Police Department for 20 years and said what you need to do is get rid of everyone in there and start from scratch.
Ted Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. They are the Mod Squad. Thank you, friends. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Sean.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition, Kenyatta Moon, founder of the Inseroma Academy for Holistic Thought, is back. She is the co-host of Holistic Living. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.